Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest on today's show is Stan Crow, Senior Manager of Land and Stewardship Programs in the Environmental Services Department at Tampa Electric Company, where the broad scope of his duties includes overseeing the company's Manatee Viewing Center in Apollo Beach. Crow has managed the Manatee Viewing Center spanning the 25 years he's worked for Tampa Electric Company. During that time, he's become steeped in the manatee world, learning extensively about these benign creatures, helping implement improvements in and around Big Bend Power Station. Did you know the company is now growing loads of seagrass, the primary manatee food, right around the corner from the viewing center? If I were a manatee, I'd want to spend the non-migrating portion of my year in close proximity to the Big Bend Power Station, and I'd want to have Stan Crow as my ally. Crow will be a speaker at the Florida Birding and Nature Festival, which runs in April 9th through 12th in and around Apollo Beach, featuring field and boat trips, expert seminars, keynote speakers, a nature expo, and more. Crow's talk, slated for April 10th at 11 a.m., entitled Manatees and Mankind, is expected to recount his experiences with manatees at the Viewing Center, review manatee biology and behaviors, and address population numbers and preferred habitats. I'll play back the conversation I recently recorded with Stan Crow in just a moment on Talking Animals on WMNF. Coming up later in today's program, we'll talk with Courtney Scott, the elephant consultant with In Defense of Animals, the longtime animal protection agency known for, among many other things, publishing an annual list of the 10 worst zoos for elephants. Today, we'll chiefly be discussing the Bay Area Renaissance Festival in Dade City, Florida, which features an elephant, and the festival is offering elephant rides for both kids and adults. I'll ask Courtney about how offering rides can imperil elephants and the humans involved in various ways. I'll ask her to recommend steps we can take to appeal to festival organizers to halt these elephant appearances. More details on this when Courtney Scott joins us a bit later in the show. Right now, though, let's play back my interview with Stan Crow recorded on Sunday. If you're interested in manatees, you'll likely be interested in this conversation. Plus, again, Stan will be delivering that talk on manatees April 10th as part of the Florida Birding and Nature Festival. So, recorded Sunday, here's Stan Crow on Talking Animals on WMNF. Let's welcome to Talking Animals, Stan Crow. Thanks for joining us today on the show, Stan.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.
So, in a way, I think we must start with your job title. I believe it's Senior Manager of Land and Stewardship Programs in the Environmental Services Department at Tampa Electric Company. So if I have that correct, I'm wondering if that takes two business cards to get everything in.
No, it fits all on one business card, although people don't seem to use business cards much anymore.
Yeah, it's probably an antiquated question to begin with. It was mostly just acknowledging that that's quite a title. But it does sound like a position with an enormous scope of duties. Tell me a bit about those duties.
Well, the stewardship part refers to some of our environmental stewardship programs, like our Manatee Viewing Center, the Florida Conservation and Technology Center. We've done over 100 acres of environmental restoration projects throughout our service territory. So that's what the stewardship part refers to. And the land part of the title refers to waste disposal and also environmental resource permitting. Like, we get a lot of permits to put in, say, new transmission power lines or new substations, new power plants, new solar sites. We're developing a lot of solar sites all over our service territory, and those all require environmental resource permits. And so that's a lot of what the land part of my title refers to.
Wow. So it sounds like a lot of time in bureaucratic sessions of one kind or another, trying to cut through red tape and of one kind or another as well, I'm guessing.
We deal with a lot of regulatory agencies. So yes, there is a lot of bureaucratic red tape to wade through.
For sure. But I know part of that purview and why we're talking today chiefly is that you also kind of oversee the Manatee Viewing Center and related things. So maybe you could describe the history and evolution, I guess, really, of the Manatee Viewing Center, because I know
sure. And definitely the Manatee Viewing Center is by far the coolest part of my job.
No doubt.
It's a really fun thing to be involved with. But the Manatee Viewing Center has been there almost 40 years. We'll be celebrating our 40th anniversary in December of this year. So that's a long time. And we have been free admission and free parking the entire 40 years of our existence. So I'm also very proud of that, because there's not many places left in Florida that are still free.
Right. Not to mention free parking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you know how much parking is at some places, especially if you go to a place like Disney World or some of those other theme parks. You can
Yeah,
pay
that's
$100
a
just to park.
for sure. No, that's great. So when did Tampa, it sounds like it's coming up in 40 years, as you say. So when did they first decide to welcome visitors to come see manatees, or what prompted that, I guess I should say? You know, obviously realizing manatees enjoyed the warm water produced at the Big Bend Power Station.
Sure. Well, when we added our at Big Bend Power Station, that used to be four coal-fired units. And when we added Unit 4 in 1986, that increased the amount of hot water that was being discharged in the discharge canal there. And with that, we almost immediately started seeing much larger groups of manatees enjoy the warm water discharge. And with that, more and more people were trying to look through the fence there at the curve where Big Bend Road curves and heads south and becomes Dickman Road, right there at that dangerous curve. People were parking there and trying to peer through the fence to get a glimpse of these manatees. So we decided to open it up to the public, and it's just expanded from there. And we now get probably close to 500,000 visitors on the 5.5 months that we're open.
And when are those months that it's open and not open?
We're open November 1st through April 15th. So then, therefore, we're closed April 15th to the end of, excuse me, October.
And that just reflects kind of the manatees kind of migration pattern or timetable. Is that why, or?
Yeah, once the weather starts warming up, the manatees don't need that warm water anymore. So they go out looking for food, and they can actually travel pretty far distances in the summertime. On the East Coast, manatees have traveled all the way up into the New England area. And on the West Coast, our manatees here, some of them travel all the way over to Texas. So folks think of manatees as being very slow-moving creatures, but they are slow, but they're very persistent, and they can travel long distances.
And that makes me wonder, because certain animals that typically migrate, there's often a few or even a segment that don't migrate, that kind of stay put. Do you find that ever with manatees or?
Yeah, and it's typically the males that travel so far in the summer months. Not always, but typically it's a male thing.
So some females kind of stay back or stay near the plant and the viewing station, et cetera, or?
Not necessarily near the plant, but stay around Tampa Bay and along the golf course where or golf coast where there are seagrasses for them to eat.
Right. So they're not staying put exactly, but they're not migrating the way a lot of their
Correct.
fellow, mostly males, are. Yeah.
Correct.
And the power station's discharge canal is, I think, read a state and federally designated sanctuary. So
That is correct.
when did it achieve that status, and to what extent did being named a sanctuary alter how Tampa Electric viewed its commitment, I guess, to the Manatee Viewing Center and to manatees more broadly?
I don't remember the exact date that the canal was designated a manatee sanctuary, but it was soon after that Unit 4 came online, and we started seeing large numbers of manatees there. So I would say probably in the early 90s.
Okay. And did the company, once it was named that status, a designated state and federally designated sanctuary, did the company receive any kind of funding or grants reflecting that status, or conversely, did it invest even more in the manatee program having been named a sanctuary?
We definitely didn't receive any money because of that designation. And I don't think we could really say that the company put more money into the facility because of that designation. The money we've invested in the facility is really because of the crowds that we're seeing there, knowing that it's such a popular attraction in Tampa Bay. And so we do a lot of improvements just to accommodate the crowds and make it a more pleasant viewing experience for the visitors.
No, it seems like there's a real commitment on the company's part to keep expanding and improving the sort of amenities and just the viewing experience and coming and going and doing other stuff. So it seems
That's
like,
right.
yeah. Who doesn't love manatees, I guess, is the key phrase there. Yeah. So this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dan Crow, Senior Manager of Land and Stewardship Programs in the Environmental Services Department at Tampa Electric Company, where he oversees the Manatee Viewing Center in Apollo Beach, I'll also be a speaker at the Florida Birding and Nature Festival, April 9 through 12, featuring all kinds of field and boat trips, expert seminars, keynote speakers, and a nature expo and more. His festival talk is entitled Manatees and Mankind, and the festival website is floridabirdingandnaturefestival.org. This interview was recorded Sunday. So tell me about your own history with manatees. I believe you were in West Palm Beach before relocating to the Tampa area. Is that where you grew up or?
Yeah, I was born and grew up in West Palm Beach, but once I went away to college, I have lived on the west coast of Florida since graduating from college. Next year will be 50 years ago. And I have to say, I wasn't that aware of manatees when I lived on the east coast, because there is a facility similar to the Manatee Viewing Center.
Yeah.
A beach that's operated by Florida Power and Light, but that really wasn't there when I was a young person growing up in West Palm Beach. So you would hear occasional sightings of manatees, but no place where you would see hundreds and hundreds gathered in one place during the winter like you see now.
So I guess it was only later, after college or after relocating or both, that manatees became something you were more aware of. And at some point, I guess, when did they start meaning something to you?
I would say as soon as I started working for the company, for Tampa Electric Company, and became involved with the Manatee Viewing Center, because it's really a sight to see that many manatees gathered in one place. And we've had, our highest count has been 1,100 manatees there at one time.
In the viewing center area? Or
in the discharge canal there, yep, absolutely. Yeah. And when that official count was done, they actually observed another 200 manatees at the mouth of the canal that they assumed had either just left the discharge canal or were getting ready to come in. So I think it's fair to say we probably had 1,300 manatees there at one time.
So that's the peak count, it sounds like.
Yes, that is definitely the most. And when you think the total population is maybe around 6,000, that's a significant, you know, portion of the statewide population.
Yeah. Well, word's out. It's a good place to hang out if you're a manatee. So they probably did some recruiting based on the facilities you guys put together there.
Very likely.
So sounds like where becoming aware of manatees personally and professional element dovetailed really when you started working at the company. You hadn't really been a big manatee person prior to that.
Yeah, that's fair to say.
So how long have you been overseeing the Manatee Viewing Center at this point?
About 26 years. That's how long I've been with Tampa Electric Company.
Wow. Do you feel like you're starting to get the hang of it?
I certainly hope so.
Yeah, just kidding. But so I realize your portfolio at the company, as we've kind of touched on a little bit, extends well beyond the Manatee Viewing Center. But when it comes to that part of the job, the manatee part, what do you love most about it?
I would say the interaction with visitors, because we truly get visitors from all over the world, and many people are seeing manatees for the first time. And so it's just really fun to be able to share that experience with those visitors. And the other thing about the Manatee Viewing Center that I haven't mentioned yet is that it's not only manatees, there's lots of other wildlife you can see there as well. We get spotted eagle rays that sometimes jump up out of the water. We get several species of sharks, and some of those will jump up out of the water and make big splashes. We get sometimes see bottlenose dolphins. There's at least 100 large tarpon that hang out there. And this season, we've seen up to 6 Goliath grouper. So on the rare days that there may not be any manatees in the canal, there are still plenty of other wildlife to see.
And do all those other ones, including, I guess, mainly I'm thinking the sharks, get along with each other, or is there ever any conflict?
No, we never see any conflict between the sharks and the manatees, or the sharks and the tarpon, or the Goliath grouper. Everyone seems to get along pretty well. I'm sure there's stuff happening below the surface with much smaller fish that may not be a happy.
Right, season. Not be aware, yeah. So would it be talking to the visitors or other elements as well that you find like most rewarding all these years later about overseeing the Manatee Viewing Center?
Yeah, definitely interaction with the public and just being able to share that first time thrill with them is really a great experience.
So we talked about the kind of peak number a moment ago. which was the question I was going to ask you about anyway. But what sort of unusual confluence of factors accounted for that huge a number, and how often have you come close to approaching that number again, or is that starting to be more standard even?
No, definitely not more standard, and it's definitely weather related. So when that number of 1,300 was counted, it was during an extremely cold spell, and so we may have gotten close to that this winter because it got extremely cold for a week or so this year as well. Yeah. Manatees become cold stress when the water temperature drops below 68, 69 degrees.
Yeah.
And just as a point of reference, with that worst of the cold weather we had this year, the temperature out in the bay got down to 51 degrees. That's quite a bit colder than manatees are able to tolerate. And you may have heard recently that down in Fort Myers, there's a power plant down there that discharges warm water that attracts manatees. And they had some kind of equipment malfunction, and about 30 manatees died, most likely a cold stress down there.
Yeah, I did see that. It's a horrible story. And they're just so sensitive. And I guess there's just no leeway when that temperature drops. But so when there is a cold spell like we had, and temperatures were, you know, I guess really in the 30s, kind of at the lowest there, their air temperature, obviously.
Yes.
So was there a bigger influx of manatees making their way to the visiting center? Like, is that sort of a correlation when it's that cold, did more even come at that point?
Yes, absolutely. There's a direct correlation there.
And would that be kind of reapproaching the number we talked about earlier, that 1,300 or thereabouts, or?
There has not been an official count that I've seen yet, but I do know that one of the local TV stations reported there were about 1,000 there. They did a couple of aerial flyovers of the canal during that cold peak, and they saw how many manatees were in the canal. So yeah, we could have come close. I just haven't seen an official count from the wildlife agency yet.
So in a way, this kind of brings me to noting there are manatee rescue and rehabilitation efforts there as needed. Do those fall within the purview of your job at all, or?
Only that we provide the space for that rehabilitation capture and release to occur. We have a special ramp that we put in at the Manatee Viewing Center, so it makes it very easy to take rehabilitated manatees down to the water's edge, or to also help facilitating getting them back out of the water if they need to be rescued. And the reason that the rehabilitation centers like to release rehabilitated manatees at a place like the Manatee Viewing Center is that a lot of times rehabilitated manatees were captured as orphan calves. And so they've spent most of their life in captivity and haven't necessarily learned natural manatee behavior. So they like to release them in a space where there's a lot of other manatees. So hopefully they can observe that natural manatee behavior and more easily adjust to life out on the wild.
So kind of follow the example of the other manatees and hopefully not be kind of in peril that you might be if you didn't know what to do.
Right, because that's behaviors they would normally learn from their mothers. But since they were captured as orphan calves, they haven't had that opportunity to learn those natural behaviors from their mothers.
So hopefully there's role models when they're out amongst the people in the...
Yes.
Yeah. So when a manatee is affected by cold stress, are they already like in deep trouble, or can they be rehabilitated at that point, or is that a matter of how severe and how extended their time has been exposed to the cold water?
Yeah, it really is a function of how long the exposure was and how cold they got. But they typically, as long as the weather warms back up, they typically do recover. And what happens when a manatee gets cold stress, it'll get white spots on its skin. And if the weather warms up, those white spots usually have a chance to heal. But if not, then they might have to be captured and be put into rehabilitation for a while until they can be returned to the wild.
And what is rehabilitation with a cold stress situation with the spots? What does that involve, and how long before they can be released, assuming it goes well?
It would just depend on the condition of the manatee. Hopefully, they wouldn't have to be in rehabilitation very long, but it would just depend on how bad the cold injuries were and how long it took to heal. But typically, if they're in tanks with a constant water temperature and they're getting a good diet, they should be able to recover fairly quickly.
Oh, that's good, because I wasn't sure how dire it was once they were really exposed to that kind of cold. And sounds like chances for recovery are typically good under the right circumstance.
Yeah, again, it just depends on how cold it got and how long they were exposed before they were able to get to warm water.
With this last cold snap, where the temperatures were really, really cold, did you find more of them that needed to kind of get that kind of rehabilitation, and did were more of them okay, or were they?
We didn't find that at our facility, because we were able to keep at least a minimum water temperature in our discharge canal for the manatees.
Okay.
So
altering in that situation, are you actually altering the water temperature beyond what just the normal process of the plant does?
Yes. If we know that it's going to get that cold, we will sometimes run units that we would not otherwise run, just to make sure we are able to maintain that minimum temperature, because that's actually required by permit.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Do you do the viewing center, et cetera, and the other things that go with the rehab and whatever?
Yes.
Wow. Well, that's great, because otherwise that seems like pretty amazing that beyond just what's warm weather, warm water there that is provided, that you're actually making it warmer when the cold snap comes and saving more manatees that way from getting the cold stress. That's great.
Yes.
So again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Stan Crow, who is part of his broad duties working for the Tampa Electric Company, oversees the Manatee Viewing Center in Apollo Beach. He'll also be a speaker at the Florida Birding and Nature Festival running April 9 through 12. His talk is entitled Manatees and Mankind. The festival website, chock full of information, schedules, and all kinds of other info, is floridabirdingandnaturefestival.org. This interview was recorded Sunday. So I mentioned it two or three times, including just then, Stan, about your upcoming talk, again, as part of the Florida Birding and Nature Festival that's running April 9 through 12 in and around Apollo Beach. So your talk is Manatees and Mankind. I don't want you to give too much away, but can we get a bit of a sneak preview of the talk?
Sure. Well, I'm going to go into a little bit of the life history of manatees, how they evolved, also their closest relatives from around the world. And then a big part of the talk will really feature impacts of man on manatees. So really, manatees don't have any natural predators, but humans are the biggest problem for manatees. Either we hit them with boats, or we create pollution that causes red tide blooms. There's just all kinds of things that happen to manatees because of man. Because unfortunately, humans want to live right on the water, and that's where manatees are. And we also, want a boat and fish in shallow areas where the seagrass beds are. So sometimes the boat propellers tear up the seagrass beds, and then there's less food for the manatees. So again, we just impact them in all kinds of ways. So a big part of the talk will be about that.
And how did they evolve? What kind of species are related to the manatees that we might know or might not know, for that matter?
Well, surprisingly, one of the closest living relatives is the elephant. And there's also a rock shrew, I think, that's in the Middle East area that is also considered a close living relative. And if you've ever seen a skeleton of a manatee, you'll notice that the bones in their flipper actually look like the bones on our hand. And that's one of the ways they know that these have, in the past, evolved from land mammals. So at one point, they probably had feet, and that's why they have these toes or these bones in their flippers, because otherwise you wouldn't need that kind of a bone structure for a flipper. But it's really interesting to see. And by the way, I will have actual manatee bones that I'll be sharing with the visitors during my talk, and they'll be able to pass those around and actually handle those. And that's a rare opportunity to get to actually handle real manatee bones like that.
Are those otherwise sort of protected in some way or not normally?
Yeah, it's illegal to have manatee bones. We have a permit at the Manatee Viewing Center because it's an educational facility.
Yeah.
So these bones are on loan from the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, and we do have permission to use those in our educational outreach events.
So let's talk more specifically about the details of your talk. So it falls during the Florida Birding and Nature Festival. I've covered that kind of, and the dates of the festival, April 9th through 12th. But I believe your talk is on April 10th?
Yes, that's correct.
And where specifically will you be giving that talk?
The bulk of the Florida Birding and Nature Festival happens just south of the Manatee Viewing Center at the Suncoast Youth Conservation Center.
Yeah.
There's a really nice educational facility there. And downstairs, there's going to be a nature expo with a variety of exhibitors and vendors selling all kinds of nature-related items, and also handing out very important information on environmental restoration and other topics like that. And then upstairs, there's a very nice classroom space, and that's where the seminars will be going on. And there are seminars all day Saturday, all day Friday, and all day Sunday, in a variety of topics, everything from flamingos to sharks to manatees to snail kites. It's a really impressive variety of topics that are going to be covered by our speakers.
Yeah, they've done this festival a number of years. This is the first year I think they moved it after a tough time with the hurricanes. It used to be in October, I believe, and they moved this. The first time it's in April.
But that's correct. We used to do it in October to try to catch all the migratory bird species as they were coming down in the fall.
Yeah.
But that summer when we, or the late summer when we had those two hurricanes back to back, Milton and Helene, it did a lot of damage to our field trip sites. And so we weren't able to go into a lot of field trip sites that we had planned on. And of course, it was really disappointing for people that were planning on doing those trips, because we actually have people come in from all over the country for this festival. So it's very disappointing to make that effort to get here and then find out some of your field trips have been canceled. So we thought it might be safer to move it to the spring. And so just like the fall, we were trying to catch all those migratory species and their fall migration. Well, in the spring, they're heading back north. So we hope to catch them the other way, and going back the other way in the spring.
That's great. And again, we should say the website is floridabirdingandnaturefestival.org. All kinds of information, the schedule of speakers and talks and the Nature Expo and all that stuff is found right on that website. It's very comprehensive, and there's a lot of great programming that's offered. And again, it's the first time it's in April, but hopefully it'll be weatherproof and on with the show.
We should be. There certainly shouldn't be any hurricanes in April, and the rainy season won't have started yet, although I wouldn't be at all disappointed if the rainy season did start early this year with this drought we're in.
Yeah, we could use some rain, for sure. Scheduled or not. So a couple of the things, Stan, I'm curious about is, I think the electric company amidst all its other efforts to help and accommodate manatees, has kind of a whole seagrass element that they try to, you know.
Yes.
Maybe you could talk about that.
Sure, because manatees primarily eat seagrass. And believe it or not, they eat 10% of their body weight every day. So if you have a really large manatee, say that weighs 1,500 pounds, it needs to eat 150 pounds of seagrass a day. So that takes a lot of seagrass to keep manatees well fed. And so in the Apollo Beach area, just south of the discharge canal, we noticed there was a area of shallow water where there were no seagrasses growing, but seemed like it would be an ideal spot for seagrasses to grow. And so we worked with Ecosphere Restoration Institute, who had gotten a grant from the state to plant 100 acres of seagrass around the state, and decided to do two of those 100 acres just south of the Manatee Viewing Center discharge canal. And then Tampa Electric decided to pay for a third acre of seagrass restoration. So these 3 acres of seagrass were planted late summer, this past summer. And so once spring is here, we hope to get out and see just how well they did, how well they fared through the winter. Hopefully they've done quite well. And hopefully those 1,300 manatees didn't discover it all at once and wipe it out, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Check that out as soon as we can.
It certainly sounds like the company couldn't be more accommodating in the manatees one way or the other. Adding the seagrass is a huge element, I would think. just given how much there's been shortages of seagrass and other issues over the years.
Yeah, because as you probably know, over on the East Coast a few years ago, there was a big seagrass die-off because of polluted water that was released from Lake Okeechobee into the Indian River Lagoon.
Yeah.
And that polluted water caused a massive algae bloom that then shaded out the water, so the seagrass died and hundreds of manatees starved to death. It was really heartbreaking to see that.
Yeah, that's awful. So this will help mitigate any shortages of seagrass. It sounds like these acres you guys have planted.
We certainly hope that's the case. And I think we actually have permits to plant 5 acres of seagrass. So if this is successful, if those first 3 acres are successful, we have every intention of planting 2 more additional acres as allowed by permit.
Well, that's great. Is there any way to assess after these are starting to grow, like how well they're doing compared to what your hopes are? Or is it just like you'll know later on?
Well, what'll happen is the person that planted the seagrass, the company that planted the seagrass, they'll go out by boat and with some staff with snorkeling gear. And so they'll actually get down in the water and observe and just see what the percent coverage is of those areas where the seagrasses were planted.
Interesting. And this goes back a little bit to our numbers and our population count. But I was wondering, is there any kind of method for tracking, at least generally, the comings and goings of specific manatees? Like, are there certain traits that a certain manatee has? Could be unfortunate, like a propeller strike or something else mm-hmm. that makes it like, well, there's Harry over there, but in that part of the viewing
yes.
station.
So, sadly, what you're describing is exactly what happens. You hardly ever see a manatee without some kind of scars on it from boat strikes and other injuries. And every manatee has its own unique scar pattern. And so the scientists will actually track that. They have a pretty good record of which manatee has which scars. And so they're able to track them that way. Sometimes when they release a rehabilitated manatee at the Manatee Viewing Center, they'll actually put a tag on them so they can track them for a few weeks and just make sure they're doing well and adjusting to life out in the wild. But they definitely can be tracked.
I wonder if there are some that have been around or known in one way or another for many, many years, maybe even decades, or is there like any grizzled old manatees that you guys really know from way back when?
Yeah, we do see some manatees that come back year after year to the Manatee Viewing Center.
Yeah.
And we had a longtime employee at the Manatee Viewing Center. He actually worked for the company for, I want to say, 36 years and then worked at the Manatee Viewing Center once he retired for at least another 20, maybe.
Wow.
Actually, altogether, he had over 60 years service in with the company, but they actually named a manatee that frequented the Manatee Viewing Center after him. His name was Howard, and so Howard got a manatee named after him.
As well he should.
Yes, as well he should, for sure.
Yeah, that's great. Well, that sounds good. So I'm kind of curious, seems like whether it's a Howard or someone else or someone they're just visiting, seems like, what about manatees speaks to people in your experience? I mean, what enchants them? I mean, it seems like it's something more profound than just the gentle giant thing.
Yes, it is more than that, but that is certainly a big part of it. I mean, because they're just such peaceful creatures. They're, you know, because they eat nothing but grass, they're not aggressive towards any other species. And when you see them at the Manatee Viewing Center, because they're there just to enjoy the warm water, you just see them lolling about, and it's like their spa day. And so they truly are gentle giants. Again, they don't have any natural prey that they go after. They don't harm anyone. They just mind their own business. Very
yeah.
peaceful animals.
And maybe partly their very vulnerability is also what speaks to people in some ways, perhaps.
Yes, and that is true. And especially if we have an injured manatee at the Manatee Viewing Center, you know, people really respond to that. If you see a manatee with especially bad scars or sometimes they have nasty gashes on their side where they've been struck by a boat, that people just really can feel that
yeah.
when they see it.
So when a manatee enters the viewing center there, how long are they typically there? I mean, does it vary from manatee to manatee? Is there X amount of days that are kind of typical stay or?
Not really. It just depends on how cold the weather is because there's nothing for them to eat in the canal there. They really are there just for the warm water.
Okay.
And we're not allowed to feed them. That's illegal. And so they're just there long enough for the water to warm up enough for them to be able to leave and go out and get food.
So the seagrass that you guys are cultivating is obviously in a different location entirely.
Yeah, it's just south of the discharge canal there, but there's a really long wall that separates the canal from this area where the seagrass was planted. So they'd have to go all the way to the end of the canal and then go around the end of that wall to get to the seagrass planting area. But it's not a huge distance. They certainly travel much further distances to get food.
And just out of curiosity, what's the rationale behind preventing them being fed in a place like a viewing center?
The wildlife agencies don't want manatees becoming dependent on man, on humans for food, because they don't want them to lose whatever natural fear they might have of humans. If we're attracting manatees with food or fresh water, it just typically puts them in harm's way.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, so let's keep that kind of safe distance and have them go look for their seagrass.
Yes.
Yeah, cool. Well, Stan, I think we're sort of reached about the end of our time. Anything else you'd like to add either about manatees, the viewing station, or your viewing center, I should say, or your upcoming talk?
Real quick, I'd like to mention that I'm the Manatee Viewing Center, and then where the festival is going to be, the Suncoast Youth Conservation Center. Those are actually, they anchor the two ends of this really large campus called the Florida Conservation and Technology Center. And that is all land that's owned by Tampa Electric Property, but we've opened it up to our partners, and our partners are the Florida Aquarium, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, and the University of Florida. So down there at the south end of the campus where our partners have their operations, the Florida Aquarium has a sea turtle rehabilitation center, and you will be able to visit that if you come to the Birding and Nature Festival. They also have a coral research facility that's doing some truly groundbreaking work on coral research. And then FWC, in addition to that Suncoast Youth Conservation Center, has a fish hatchery where they're going to be producing 1 million redfish and spotted sea trout a year. And then University of Florida is the other partner on site. And we have a full-time associate professor on site that always has a half a dozen or so of graduate and PhD level students working on various research projects. So there's all kinds of stuff going on here, and it's all property owned by Tampa Electric Company that we've opened up to our partners and to the public.
Sounds like a lot of great research is going on there. And am I remembering correctly that this is like a sprawling, like, is there 500 acres total, this center, or am I misremembering that?
Yes, it's a little over 500 acres. It's anchored to the north by the Manatee Viewing Center. And at the south is the Center for Conservation, where our partners have their operations. And in between is some really nice coastal habitat that we've preserved with nature trails running through it, as well as a quarter mile long boardwalk that goes out to a 50 foot high observation tower. So you could truly spend an entire day on this campus.
Sounds like quite a thing to behold. That's great. And it sounds like, again, some very important research is being conducted there all the
Absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely.
That's great. All right. Well, Stan, we've been speaking with Stan Crow, again, Senior Manager of Land and Stewardship Programs in the Environmental Services Department at Tampa Electric Company. And again, look for his talk entitled Manatees and Mankind, April 10th, as part of the Florida Birding and Nature Festival. And again, the website to find out more details about Stan's talks and other field trips and other outings by boat and all kinds of great stuff. It's floridabirdingandnaturefestival.org. And again, this interview was recorded Sunday. So Stan, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your experiences and knowledge about manatees, and some of there'll be more of the same on April 10th.
You're very welcome. Thanks again for the opportunity.
Thank you. All right, my thanks again to Stan Crow for joining us on Talking Animals for that interview. Who doesn't like hearing about manatees? I know I do. In a moment, I'll speak with Courtney Scott, elephant consultant with In Defense of Animals, who will discuss the Bay Area Renaissance Festival in Dade City, Florida, which is offering elephant rides currently. Hard to understand how a Renaissance Festival features an elephant on the grounds, but we do understand that it's not good for the elephant. I'll ask Courtney why it's not good for the elephant and how we might voice our objections to the Renaissance Festival. Join us in just on the program just a moment or two from now. Right now, though, we're going to step into the comedy corner with a piece relevant to the conversation we just had with Stan Crow. Here's Jim Gaffigan with part of a piece called I'm a Manatee on Talking Animals on WMNF.
My favorite animal is the manatee, the sea cow. The manatee is endangered with extinction, and I think it's because it's out of shape. It looks like a retired football player. You see the manatee on the Discovery Channel? It's always floating around like, I'm bloated. Too much pizza for me. The manatee is also called the sea cow. Sea cow, that sounds like an insult. It's almost as if the manatee was introduced to the ocean, the other animals were like, who's the new guy? The manatee was like, oh, hi, everyone. You can call me the manatee. Yeah, right, sea cow.
Name's manatee.
Sea cow, fat ass.
Quit it.
I'd love to see the manatee on a show like Ricky Lake. The manatee be sitting there like, Ricky, I'm here because I'm endangered. And then one of those mean people in the audience would offer up the advice, yeah, I want to say something to the sea pig. That sea cow, whatever. Sea pig, you a fat seal, you got to get yourself an education and a job. Manatee be like, I live in the ocean. Just so happen you live in the ocean because you ain't got no job. You got to get in Weight Watchers, some kind of program.
I have a layer of blubber to keep my body warm in the water.
Whatever, talk to the hand.
I don't have a hand.
What if a manatee was in the audience? They might laugh, but they'd be crying on the inside. It doesn't look like God tried that hard on the manatee, does it? He's like, all right, blood flip-flops. What the hell, let's go with a goatee. You know what, I got a golf game. Throw this around Florida, it'll fit in. Hey, I'm from Florida. I don't think God plays golf. I didn't like some of those jokes.
That was Jim Gaffigan in today's Comedy Corner with part of a piece called I'm a Manatee, taken from his album Doing My Time. Now it's time to speak with Courtney Scott, elephant consultant with In Defense of Animals, about the Bay Area Renaissance Festival in Dade City that's currently offering elephant rides. Let's learn more by welcoming Courtney Scott back to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Courtney.
Good morning. How are you, Duncan?
Great. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals. And maybe we can start with asking you to provide a brief overview of In Defense of Animals. What is it? A little bit about its history and mission and so on.
Well, In Defense of Animals is an international animal rights group that's been advocating to end confinement and abuse and neglect of animals for 40 years. And I specialize in elephants. I'm the elephant consultant.
Okay, great. And I alluded to the list earlier in the show, and we're here today to discuss an elephant we're concerned with at the Renaissance Fair. But it feels fitting kind of to ask about the origin of IDA's longstanding 10 worst zoos for elephants list. How does it work? When did it start? And what does it seem to accomplish when you put out the new list each year?
Well, it started about 20 years ago, actually. And the first elephants that were sent to sanctuary were back in that day when two elephants from the San Francisco Zoo were sent to Paws Sanctuary, and the elephant exhibit was closed. And since that time, 40 more zoos have closed their elephant exhibits. So that is, we feel, is from all the pressure we've put on the zoos over the years. And we believe it is a good you know, step towards ending elephant captivity.
And how often do zoos move on or off the list from year to year?
How often do they what? I'm sorry?
How often do they move on or off the list from year to year? I mean, it sounds like it's kind of a fresh, updated list each year, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, it really depends on what we're focused on that year. For instance, this last year, we focused on breeding. And so if a zoo is doing aggressive breeding, for instance, then we're going to focus on it for 2025. That zoo might have been on the list another year for another issue. Let's say early death or disease or taking elephants from Africa. You know, there's different issues that zoos get on the list for. So if they have repeat visits to the list, it's because they're, you know, doing something else that we're focusing on for that year.
And do zoos that make it on the list seem to consider making any changes based on what they've been added to the list for?
Yeah, they do. For instance, we focused on bull hooks for a number of years. And, for instance, the Oregon Zoo stopped using the bull hooks due to, I think, public, they admitted it was due to public pressure. And then, of course, by 2021, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums regulated zoos and said they have to stop using bull hooks and use protected contact. So the whole move towards protected contact took a number of years, but it did finally succeed.
That's great. It's nice to see progress and inroads with something like
right.
that.
It's a step. Right?
Yeah.
Ultimately, we want to see no elephants in captivity, and especially zoos.
Sure. All right, so we talked 2 years ago about the Bay Area Renaissance Festival in Dade City, and it's then sort of prominent touting of an elephant performing there and giving elephant rides. So remind me of what course of action you recommended back then, and then we'll get into kind of what's happening currently at the Renaissance Festival.
Yeah, well, what we recommend then and what we recommend now is to end elephant riding. You know, I think it's kind of surprising and shocking in a way that right here in the U.S., people are riding elephants still. Because in Asia, where elephant riding is, you know, very prevalent, even there, they're making progress. For instance, recently, Indonesia banned all elephant riding. And many elephant camps and tourist facilities over the years recently have transitioned to ethical facilities where there is no riding. And even in some of them, there's no interaction. So that includes bathing and selfies, because those activities are just as damaging to elephants, because they've been forced to comply with that kind of interaction through brutal training. So I just find it very disturbing that there's these Renaissance fairs like the one in Dade City that are still offering elephant rides.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, at least in Virginia, that facility closed down and had to send their elephants to Florida.
We may have lost Courtney. Let me see if I can get her back. This is Talking Animals on WMF. Okay, we've got Courtney back here. So I guess, does it represent progress, I guess, along the lines of what we're talking about, that the elephant has lower key presence at the current festival, or is it still, the chief problem is it's still at the fest, just maybe with a little bit more...
Yeah, you're saying that they're not promoting it as much?
It seems like it's not as... I remember when we spoke a couple of years ago, it was really touted, and there was this woman that was, you know, the elephant's handler/owner, and it seemed like that was splashed all over the Renaissance Festival thing. This, you still find the information, but you kind of have to hunt for it. So I don't know if that's better or worse.
Well, yeah, you make a good point. It's hard to judge that. But I would say it's better because it shows that there is a change in perception.
Yeah.
And they're trying to disguise it. So I think that is a step in the right direction. You know, it's just, it takes time for these changes to happen. But I believe that the public is becoming more aware, and that's one of the signs.
And for people who may not be aware, you talk about the kind of some of the changes internationally and otherwise, but just when it comes down to a basic elephant ride, what are the detriments for the elephant involved in an elephant ride? Just physically and emotionally, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it is a physical damage is done to the elephant because, as I explained last time, the elephant's spine is protrudes out of their back. It's not like a horse that has kind of a saddleback. The spine is actually protruding. So you're sitting right on top of the spine.
Yeah.
So over years, that's going to create all kinds of problems for the elephant. But beyond that, something I've been thinking about looking at these photos of Lady Essex and Lauren is it's an attack on an elephant's dignity. I saw a video where she is actually having the elephant paint, which means she's putting paint right onto the nostril of the elephant's trunk and then putting that poor elephant's trunk onto a canvas to create this, you know, tourist-friendly activity.
Yeah.
And what is that? That's not something elephants do.
Right.
You know, in other words, they're just creating these things for elephants to do that have nothing to do with a normal elephant behavior. And elephants are really, you know, one of the most intelligent, social, highly evolved species on Earth. And then they do so many things that are amazing. Like they have their own language.
Yeah.
Scientists have discovered recently. They actually call each other by name. There's just so much. They echolocate.
Right.
They just have so
we
many
love things. Elephants for all these reasons.
Yeah.
So we're almost out of time here, Courtney, I'm afraid.
Okay.
So what would you recommend, like, how would you say people should contact maybe the Bay Area Renaissance Festival and register their objections to having the elephant rides?
Yes. I absolutely support that and encourage people to do that because the more people that do that, the more it's going to move away from having elephant rides at their festival every year.
All right. Well, I'd like to think we're making progress. So hopefully when we talk 2 years from now, we'll be talking about the elephant rides are gone.
That sounds great, Duncan.
Okay, Courtney. Thank you so much. This has been Courtney Scott on Talking Animal. Thank you so much, Courtney.
Hi, Duncan.
Coming up on WMNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WMNF's brief news recap. Then we shift back to music programming with Sam Ball holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy hosting the Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m. And there's more great programming on WMNF here, 88.5. Meanwhile, next Wednesday on Talk Animals, happy to report Glenn Hatchell will be back for another edition of Ask the Trainer. Again, you may recall those shows. People can call in or write in, ask Glenn for guidance or help about their dogs or cats' behavior. And a really helpful, great show. So that's next Wednesday, March 11th, here on Talking Animals on WNF Tampa.